Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Hello, everybody. I'm Molly Wood.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to Make Me Smart. We try to get a little smarter together every single week.
Every single week. This week, we are going to try to get a little smarter about privacy, something we've been talking about for a while, and something that you asked us last week in our Make Me Smart editorial meeting to dive into. But before we tell you one single other thing, we have to play for you the greatest news peg of all time. As it happens, last week at a town hall with Representative Jim Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin, a constituent was upset about the congressman's role, his vote to repeal internet privacy laws. And this is what he said in response to that.
Well, you know, again, you know, nobody's got to use the internet.
I think we should play that cut one more time. Let's play it one more time just to make sure everybody heard that.
Let it sink in.
Well, you know, again, you know, nobody's got to use the internet.
Now, Congressman, far be it for me
to
disagree. Yeah, there's a little typing there. But far be it for me to disagree with a sitting congressperson in the United States, who I will hasten to point out took a seat in 1979 before there actually was an internet. Are you kidding me? Come on, man. God.
Yeah.
That's all I got on that one.
Yeah. Nobody's got to use the internet. The most amazing part is that following the posting of video about that comment and people having a fit, someone tweeted and said he tells his constituents not to use the internet if they don't like his vote to sell out privacy to their advertisers.
Yeah.
The Sensenbrenner Press Office Twitter account, the irony here is crushing, as I'm sure you imagine, Twitter account, responded and said, actually, he said that nobody has to use the internet. They have a choice. Big difference. Big difference.
Yeah.
This is where I'd like to point out that the United Nations considers internet access a human right related to Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And the United States signed on to this 2016 resolution declaring it a human right. Never mind the digital divide. But this is the response. And this is how votes like this, by the way, happen in privacy, because I think the technology issues are greatly misunderstood.
Well, yeah, but I also think, honestly, people like Sensenbrenner, and not to get down on an old guy, but he just doesn't understand. How can you say something like that and understand?
Well, yeah, but that's terrifying, right? It's one thing,
right?
Like, it's one thing if your cranky grandfather in an armchair doesn't totally understand why the internet is so important. This is a sitting congressman, like you and I didn't have the internet when I was born, but I am capable of understanding its impact on the lives of every single human being on earth.
No, that's true.
And the idea that there is in fact not a choice if you want to participate in modern society. So that people, whatever weird like bubble he's been living in where other people Google for him, that's not good for us.
No. But suffice it to say, just with that as a tease, we are going to get into that a little bit. The whole privacy and use and technology and all of that jazz. Mm-hmm. With a guy by the name of Joel Reitenberg. He directs the Fordham University Center on Law and Information Policy. He is oh so mellow, even as he tells you that we are apocalyptically hosed digital privacy-wise. It was a very distressing conversation, I have to say. That's all I got.
Also, T-shirt alert for apocalyptically hosed.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. Also on the show today, we have got tons of comments about our conversation with George Lakoff from all of you. We're going to play a bunch of those in a bit. But first, I just...
Want to hear it again?
I want to hear it one more time. Can I just hear it one more time?
Well, you know, again, you know, nobody's got to use the internet.
Nobody's got to use it unless you want to hear this show.
We should FedEx him a CD with this show on.
On the topic of privacy, this, by the way, of course, came about, in case you missed this story, it came about because Congress, as you know, recently voted to block rules from going into effect that would have let consumers opt in to having their information potentially sold by ISPs. The other irony that's crushing is that he then went on to talk about how it shouldn't be up to him to tell you whether you're going to receive advertising in exchange for your data. You should just know that it's going to happen and get the choice, even though that vote explicitly took away the option for consumers to opt out.
Yeah, pretty much completely and entirely. But, you know, other than that.
This is the world that we live in, as articulated by our own director of the FBI, James Comey.
There is no such thing as absolute privacy in America.
Ouch.
Wah, wah.
But that's the nugget of our chat with Joel Rydenberg. And it's you when it gets there, when it gets here, when it comes to us in a couple of minutes, you guys will see exactly what we mean. We're talking about all this because maybe the most, I don't want to say intrusive, but the most aware company of all our data and information and all that jazz has a big thing going on this week.
Yeah. So Facebook's developer conference is this week. It's the time when they tell everybody about all the new products they have in store for their 1.23 billion,
amazing,
billion with a B, daily active users, all of whom, all of us, I assume, most of us on this podcast right now use Facebook in some form, for example, for our own live videos every Monday.
Yep.
We give them incredible amounts of personal data for free. We let them track us all across the internet in some cases. I don't because I use a little plugin called Disconnect, but they do. And they are not the only ones. All right. What do you, Kai, what do you worry the most about? I mean, this is like the thing that it comes down to with privacy, right? Is everybody still does this. Everybody still gets on Facebook, still uses Google, still has location services turned on their phones. What worries you the most, Kai Rizdahl, about digital privacy?
So here comes I guess you're going to call this a disclaimer. I'm not terribly worried about digital privacy. It's... You know, me and Jim Sensenbrenner, I guess. I don't know.
Is it because you think you don't necessarily have to use the internet or because you think that horse has already left the barn?
I think the horse has left the barn. And maybe I'm a special example because the government, through my military and civilian careers in the government, I mean, they've got dossier upon dossier on me. And now private companies are going to have that as well. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. I'm conflicted because I haven't, you know, I don't know.
I know. I think most people say that privacy is important and their actions suggest otherwise. I think most people don't know to what extent their privacy is being collected. But I have also been on record as saying that there hasn't been so far a case of measurable harm from companies having a lot of access to your data. I think what's interesting is the conversation that we are about to play, which is the question of what's happening that we don't know about. For example, do you read the privacy policy?
Right. So first of all, I don't. But let me back up for a minute. Here's the deal. And it just crystallized now as we're sitting here talking about it, and I confessed to being a Luddite on this issue fundamentally. We are now still having the, oh my God, it's the principle of the thing discussion, which is a completely valid conversation to have. But I'm more interested in tangible harm and acts of misdeed and acts of misdeeds and misdoing. And while it's annoying to be marketed to based on geographic location, while it's annoying to be marketed to based on something I clicked on 3 days ago and Facebook now pulls that, you know, up and says, oh, yeah, let me show you 14 ads for a new pair of running shoes or whatever. We're still very much in the, oh, my gosh, isn't this terrible, but I can't tell you exactly why phase yet. That's where I am, if that makes any sense. I don't know.
No, I completely agree. That makes perfect sense. And I think that's, I would argue, too, that if I had to choose between understanding what is in the privacy policy, which again, we're going to get to in a minute, understanding what companies are going to do with my data and which companies and why, and finding out, for example, via the Snowden leaks, that I have been potentially illegally surveilled by my own government in a way that could cause also, so far, mostly theoretical harm, but probably worse harm. I think the government thing is worse. I think government surveillance may be worse than corporate surveillance because the corporations don't want to lose me, but the government might think I'm somebody else and put me in jail.
Well, corporations have a vested interest in protecting the this is too loaded a phrase, but the sanctity of your data, right? Because if we all sort of en masse, or if there's a big giant movement that starts somehow, because things happen, right? I mean, look at the lead Uber. Things happen very quickly. then those companies are out of business. If 1.23 billion people leave Facebook, then Facebook no longer exists.
Yep.
But the idea of government intrusion seems more malevolent and less, and is explicitly intelligence gathering as opposed to finding the commercial value in these trends. You know what I mean?
Right. And trends, that's a really important point that you just made, which is that most of what is collected by companies is not, you know, you are targeted for ads, which is a scary sounding thing, but it is not a red dot on your forehead. It is an aggregation of information about people who are, I've been playing a lot of Overwatch lately.
I was just going to say, little red laser aiming dot on your forehead. Is that what we're talking about?
I have sniping on the brain because I'm trying to learn the Widowmaker character.
You need to go for a long walk in the hills and just mellow. So anyway, so do you read privacy policies? You're the tech person.
I don't read them because I'm not worried about my data in the aggregate. However, I think we have the right to know, and we don't.
Oh, yeah. But we totally have the right to know. But that's completely different. Yep. Right. And that's why everybody went bananas. I mean, there's the pure issue of the government surveillance. But part of the reason everybody went bananas about the illegal wiretaps in the Bush administration was that nobody had known about it. And we were like, oh, my God, what?
Yeah, it's not good. All right. So now we are going to take a short break, and then we are going to play the interview with Joel Weidenberg, in which we find out all of the things that we thought we knew, but we didn't about privacy policies.
All right. So Joel Weidenberg is his name. He is the director of the Center on Information Law and Policy at Fordham University in the city of New York. He has taught all over the place. He's an expert advisor to the Congress, to the Federal Trade Commission, the European Commission, and all kinds of bodies. So he's been a certified expert all over the place. So we asked him the obvious question about all those long and complicated and detailed privacy policies that we all get. Do you read them now? I mean, when you get a new cell phone, do you read your privacy policy?
He's the guy. Are you the guy?
I'm the statistical aberration. I look at them. I will confess that I don't read them the way I would if I were representing a client looking at a policy. Yeah, the policies are just not written in a way for a normal person to understand them.
There's a great thing you said in a paper you wrote about this, and you said these privacy agreements are basically meant to take the place of regulation, right? As government gets out of the business of figuring out what companies can do, companies are putting in their own verbiage, and we're all sort of beholden to that.
Absolutely. So in the United States, we don't have comprehensive data privacy legislation. We rely on a notice and choice regime where an organization collecting your information is supposed to tell you how they're going to use it, and then the individual, by agreeing to that policy by a click, accepts those terms. Well, that's a private contractual arrangement. It's not a public law that defines the parameters of privacy in the United States. And it's, I think, increasingly a real fiction that notice and choice can work to properly protect individuals' privacy.
How has that paradigm changed? Because it feels like the choice part, even. I mean, setting aside the issue of whether it can work at all, it also feels like the choice part seems to be falling by the wayside.
The user choice is either I accept whatever they're going to do with my data or I can't use the service.
So, well, now we have, you know, let's say five of the most valuable companies in the world, Apple, Alphabet, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon. Of that group, arguably three, if not all, have a big business stake in user data. And that seems to be the trend, that if you are a company, even who's not necessarily involved directly and considered a tech company, that data is an inextricable part of your business model. Does that make our consumer situation more urgent?
It certainly makes the consumer situation much more urgent. Data is the oil for the information economy in the digital age. Hmm. And who controls it, what restrictions can be imposed upon it, are really essential to determine what the balance of power and rights will be in our digital society.
Is there one of those five that you would say is more egregious or knows the most about us and we're not aware of that?
Well, I think there's a growing awareness of what some of these organizations know about individuals, but I don't think there is a true understanding of how data can be aggregated, sliced and diced, used to actually specifically identify particular individuals. The kind of information that Google will have on individuals. They know a tremendous amount about individuals' communications because those who use Gmail, their content of their messages is data mined by Google. Mm-hmm. If you're not a Gmail user, but you receive email from a Gmail user, then half of your conversation is data mined by Google. If you use Google Search, if you use Google Docs, all of this information can be aggregated to enable pretty detailed portrayals of specific individuals.
So where's the happy middle ground, right? Because it can't just be a binary choice. It can't just be either you're in the information economy and you are completely exposed and everything is transparent, or you're out but you're safe, right? What's the happy medium?
There isn't one today, actually, because I think it is inevitable. You can't really effectively unplug. Suppose, for example, you don't have a Facebook account, but your friends do, and they post a picture of you. Facial recognition technology makes that picture identifiable to you. So even though you're not participating in Facebook, Facebook has information about you in its system.
Wow. That is terrifying. That's terrible. And I speak as a Facebook lurker, right?
But it gets worse. Companies like Ford and GM are getting into data collection that involves where you drive your car, the Xbox camera and the HoloLens. Microsoft and Samsung TVs can literally see into your home. I mean, what are we staring down here in terms of the next iteration of this conversation?
Well, the issue is going forward, how are we really going to be organizing ourselves in a digital society so that we have proper checks and balances on the use of this information? But at the end of the day, for the technologies to work, there's going to be geolocation tracking, there's going to be monitoring, there are going to be ways to reconnect a data stream from one place to a data stream from another place and connect it to an individual. If a person at a senior level in government uses Google Search, what they're searching for, the patterns and transaction records of what they search for, can give a pretty good idea of what's going on inside the government office.
Wow.
If a senior government official receives an email communication that's coming from a Gmail account, half the conversation or more is going to be in that organization's servers. And you can think about the same thing on, say, the Facebook side. So they did an experiment where they wanted to see whether displaying that your friends had voted would encourage people to go out and vote. And they found a small but distinct yes response to that. That the more folks in your friend group, I guess, who voted, you were more likely to feel the peer pressure to vote. Mm-hmm. Well, think about the implications of that, where Facebook knows its users' political preferences based on their social networks and the content of what they post. They can quite easily figure out which precincts are the swing districts in different states, which puts them in a position where all they need to do is display the I voted button to people who they think will vote in a particular way because of their political preferences as expressed on their Facebook feed in the right precincts. And it doesn't take a lot of extra votes to change a result in an election.
Yeah. So if you had your druthers, what's the answer? What is the solution?
I think the solution is going to be a complicated one, which kind of defies our political process at the moment. I think the solution is going to have to be a combination of technologies that obfuscate information, technologies that enable oversight of algorithmic filtering, because a lot of these decisions, these are automated. The technology is not neutral. It's baking in value judgments. and start defining some red lines in our society, what we deem to be unacceptable use of personal information. Right now, we're sort of at a drift as to where those red lines are. And I think until we have a clearer social consensus, it's going to be very hard for us to improve or even solve these privacy problems.
Well, and there has to be enough incentive, right? Right now, I mean, it sounds like some of those tools have been developed in the past but didn't go anywhere because there's no commercial incentive for these companies to get on board.
I think that's right. Right now, the commercial incentive weighs very heavily in the data aggregation, data mining to figure out how to financially support a product. And that is a very heavy thumb on the scale where there are other important social interests that are at stake.
So at this point, is there any information that some company doesn't know about us? Is anything left for just me?
I think today it's very unlikely because with the predictive analytics, it's possible to predict things that are about you that you haven't yet realized.
Oh, for crying out loud.
And it moves us into a very different world. But if I could close on a more optimistic note than this, we're moving into a digital age in a sense. We've seen it growing and percolating for the last 20 years or so, and now we're really front and center of it. And just as we saw in previous generations moving from an agrarian world to an industrial age, and now from an industrial age to a truly digital age, it gives us fantastic opportunities for society to have great innovations, great advances in healthcare and public welfare and all sorts of things. But it's only going to happen if we consciously develop new mechanisms to govern this digital age, to govern the ways in which we collect and use information. And unless we begin to focus very carefully on the governance aspects and the accountability aspects, we risk not having all of these benefits that are, we hope, available for society in the years to come.
Now, what do you think, Kai? Remember how yesterday you were super scared, and now today you're not worried?
Well, no, but here, so let me frame it a little differently and get it away from me, and I'm going to pull back the curtain a little bit here. So we were talking about Sensenbrenner, right? I think he's probably like a 25-term congressman, actually making the laws about privacy and digital technology in this country. And I will now say that as that tape was running and as Rydenberg was saying the whole thing he was saying about Google data mining everybody's Gmails, right? Remember that bit?
Mm-hmm.
We have a little chat channel up here and we were going back and forth on this. And Jenny, our producer in the control room, said, and there are a couple of younger members of the crew in there watching, and the two millennials said, "Ooh, that's scary." About that Google data mining thing, about those Google emails.
Yeah.
So here we, and because here's the deal. Sensenbrenner says, oh yeah, you don't have to be online. And for those two people who were, the younger people who were listening to this in the control room, the idea of not having a Gmail account is like cutting off your left arm.
Right. It's unacceptable. And yet they are maybe not totally aware
exactly
of the degree of data mining. And I think that's the important thing. It's like, you could look,
yep,
we can either worry about it or not worry about it. But we all deserve to know. And one interesting part of that interview.
Right. That's the line. That's the line. Sorry. You do this all the time. You do this all the time. We can worry about it or not, but we deserve to know. That's it. We're done here.
Okay, cool. Title.
Yes.
One interesting part of that interview that we didn't, I think it was just a little in the weeds and we didn't want to spend a ton of time playing, but we talked a lot about the difference between the laws in Europe and the laws here.
Yeah.
And the fact that European privacy laws are consumer focused, period.
Yep.
And in the US, when we consider these laws, they're business focused. So you get into, like, as usual, all of the issues that we're always talking about the show, like moral capitalism, right? Where
yep.
you decide, okay, who is the focus of these laws? Is it about protecting
totally.
Us and giving us all the information we need and allowing us to make informed choices? Or is it about allowing, Comcast to keep up with Google and Facebook when it comes to business models that rely on your personal data? And I think that is a tension that is just part of being an American.
Yeah.
But I do think, speaking of the younger generation, that the ones who do know are clearly choosing practices that will drive businesses in a direction of greater privacy. Apple is actually using privacy as a differentiator.
Right.
They have said, you know, when we collect your data, we're going to make sure it's completely anonymized and you can control it. And they've, in some cases, said, we're just not interested. We're not looking at your data, period. And you see the proliferation of disappearing messages as a feature that's just getting, you know, starting, starting actually as far back as like 2012, 2013, there were disappearing message services.
Then, huh?
Oh, yeah. And then way back then. But you see, you know, the youth of today, they're choosing disappearing messages. They're choosing carefully curated profiles. They're lurking on Facebook instead of participating. Hmm. You know, the fact that stories is now a feature that's showing up in everything from Snapchat to Facebook to Instagram to, you know, you can do disappearing messages on Apple to, like, I swear to God, your fridge probably has some sort of stories feature, shows that impermanence of data is something that the next generation is choosing. And I think you'll start to see business, you know, we can still drive business even if it's not from the regulation side.
Right, right. And you have to believe it's going to go that way. Anyway, tell us what you think about all this, because obviously there is fodder aplenty in this area, because it touches each and every one of us in ways we don't even understand. Write to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. Hit us up and let us know what you think.
Next up, we have, I believe, your answers to the Make Me Smart question. Yes. But first, just like everybody else, we have got to pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, now each week we ask someone our Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about? And we this week got a great one from Chris Tanner, who has some thoughts about freedom.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Chris Tanner recording in Dallas, Texas. I grew up in the U.S. most of my life with what I would assume is a classic Western assumption that total freedom of speech is essential for prosperity and important above all else. Speaking with a colleague in Taiwan, I asked him about his thoughts on China and if he'd ever consider moving there. Very different from what I expected, however, he responded that he sees China as the future, and in fact, many people in Taiwan believe that there is too much freedom in Taiwan. Needless to say, this idea of too much freedom or too much choice was something I never considered living in the U.S., where freedom is the name of the game and the foundation of what we preach.
Hmm. I wonder if there's a, it's easy to think there's too much freedom, too much choice when you don't have to think about it, you know?
Yeah, maybe. Well, I think don't have to think about it is the thing that chooses people to choose less freedom, or that drives people to choose less freedom. Yep.
Totally true. Totally true. All right, we'll be back in just a sec with some more thoughts from y'all about the interview we did, was it last week or 2 weeks ago? Last week, I guess, with George Lakoff about words and how they're used in politics today. What was that, like disco music for a bridge? What is this, 1977? What was that? Oh my God. Put up the disco balls. All right. Anyway, we are back, as you can tell by the music. It is time to hear from you.
Where do we mail a letter?
In the mailbox.
I never get tired of that. All right. You all, I just need to have like a lot more children. You all had lots of thoughts about the interview. Not me personally.
Oh, all right. Okay.
I just want to be like around them. All right, maybe foster a bunch of them. I don't know. They're just delightful. Anyway, you had that went in a direction I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
Either,
oh, my goodness.
Frankly.
Wow.
Okay, George Lakoff was not only a profoundly thought-provoking interview for us, which it was, but it obviously had the intended effect on all of you listeners. You had tons of thoughts. Tony Wagner on our digital team put a whole bunch of them in a blog post, which I encourage you to read. It's at our website, marketplace.org/makemesmart. But we also wanted to play a few here for you, too, because for one thing, you guys are getting really good at the record some audio and send it to us. And for another thing, they're all super thoughtful.
Thank you for the interview with George Lakoff. It really helped me to understand why some of the normally smart people I know make the decisions they do.
I follow his premise. However, I object to the stratification by political affiliation. Just as in other forms of profiling, I find being profiled by political party somewhat uncomfortable. In my opinion, this diluted his message.
Hi, Molly. Thanks for your question to George Lakoff about strict father morality and the patriarchy. I was disappointed by his answer and how he explained the different moralities as a matter of nature. Yes, children need nurturing, and yes, they need discipline. But the phenomenon that he describes is not called strict parent morality, it's strict father. He himself genders it. I suspect that it is our patriarchal society that creates the conditions for this phenomenon, and there's nothing natural about it.
Loves the interview with George Lakoff. It looks increasingly like being empirically correct is not nearly as important as understanding how people process information. I find that really disturbing, but nonetheless, the intersection of cognitive and behavioral science and politics is a fascinating and crucial topic, so thanks for covering it.
Brad Rutter has won more money than anyone else in Jeopardy history, and he's beat Ken Jennings in several of the Champion Series, including the last Ultimate Champions tournament, that was guaranteed to make the winner the winningest. Come on, Kai. And if you're bringing up Watson in Jeopardy, I always think it's worth bringing up U.S. Rep. Rush Holt of New Jersey, a former five-time Jeopardy champion and nuclear physicist who actually beat Watson in an informal round of Jeopardy.
I also wanted to say that when Molly mentions having faith that people are doing what they're supposed to be doing, it made me realize why I listen. Even when she is very wrong on peanut butter eggs, or Kai is wrong on hop forward beer, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, making me smarter.
Wow, there was something in there for everybody, huh? Holy cow.
There really was. Like, can we do that every week? Because that's amazing.
I know. That was awesome. So that was Paul Wisniewski, Mike Taylor, Claire Willis, and Ali Dirks with some thoughts on everything from George Lakoff to Reese's Eggs. It was kind of amazing.
Amazing. And you all had such strong feelings about the George Lakoff interview that we're actually going to put out the transcript of the full interview. I've already had some people asking for the full audio, which might be a bit of an editing challenge, but we will put out that whole transcript so you can read through all of the rest of the fascinating stuff that he told us, including his full opinion on why Hillary Clinton lost the election. You can see that at marketplace.org/makemesmart.
And just because it was so awesome, we're going to play the rest of that voicemail from Ali Dirks right here.
Hey, Kai, Molly, and everyone in the Make Me Smart family. This is Ali Dirks in Washington, D.C. One of the reasons I love podcasts is the more intimate conversations and viewpoints you get from the hosts. In a weird way, I found Kai's fatalistic nothing matters rain cloud and the ensuing discussion rather charming. It's nice to be reminded that the people bringing us our news are, in fact, people, and sometimes the news makes even them feel like crap, and so it is coming back from vacation. The Facebook Live editorial meeting is also a lovely way to make listeners feel like part of the team and make the podcast interactive. Feeling connected to others is the wellspring of hope, and it's nice to feel like we're all in this together. Not in the name of being right, but so that we can make each other smarter. Thanks for all you guys do, and three cheers for tiny horses and avocado toast. Aw, peanut.
Oh, man. Aww. I got nothing.
That was the best. Also, can I just say that having watched a lot of the Facebook keynote today, Ali said all the things about community that Mark Zuckerberg has been trying to say, but so much better.
Because he still doesn't get it.
All right, we got nothing. That's a perfect way to end. And so off we go.
We're out of here.
Talk to you next week.
Spiritum Liberum or Liberum. I don't even know.
Free spirit. Not too free.
Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Bridget Bodner, and senior producer Nancy Fragali. This week's program was engineered by Brian Allison. He's a newbie. Be nice to him, people. Our theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive producer of Marketplace is Sitara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark, who gives us just enough freedom, but not too much.
Not too much.
And as always, if you have not subscribed to this here podcast in your podcatcher of choice, iTunes or Google Play or any of the ones you like to use, please do that. And if you wouldn't mind, please drop us a review, especially on the iTunes. It really helps us out a lot in impressing our bosses and things like that.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.